He had cut his consumption down to 3 or 4 a day. This one tasted good, even if the tobacco was stale. His cover story is simple enough and believable enough. No one's going to be able to shake him from it. And if he gets back, we can hypnotize him again. He goes under in the time it takes you to snap your fingers, and he'll tell us everything he's seen, chapter and verse. I don't doubt that. If he gets back... Yes, we gave him an instruction to travel only at night. If he was seen by more than one person to run, he accepted that okay. But if he was seen by one person only, to kill him. Stu, you didn't. Of course we did. We're not playing patty cake here, Franny. You must know what's going to happen to him or the others if they get caught over there. Why else were you so set against the idea in the first place? Okay, she said quietly. Okay, Stu. No, it's not okay, he said, and slammed the just-lit cigarette down into a pottery ashtray, sending up a cloud of little sparks. Several of them landed on the back of his hand, and he brushed them off in a quick, savage gesture. It's not okay to send a feeble kid out to fight our battles, and it's not okay to push people around like pawns on a fucking chessboard, and it's not okay giving orders to kill like a mafia boss. But I don't know what else we can do. I just don't know. If we don't find out what he's up to, there's a damn fine chance that someday next spring he may turn the whole free zone into one big mushroom cloud. Okay. Hey, okay. He unclenched his fists slowly. I was shouting at you. I'm sorry. I had no right to do that, Franny. It's okay. Anyhow, when I gave him that... What do you call it? When I said he should kill any one person that got in his way, a kind of frown came over his face. It was gone right away. I don't even know if Ralph or Nick saw it, but I did. It was like he was thinking, okay, I understand what you mean, but I'll make up my own mind on that when the time comes. I've read that you can't hypnotize someone into doing something that they wouldn't do when they're awake. A person won't go against his own moral code just because they're told to do it when they're under. Stu nodded. Yeah, I was thinking of that. What if this fellow Flagg has got a line of pickets strung down the whole eastern length of his border? I would if I were him. If Tom runs into that picket line going west, he's got his story to cover him. But if he's coming back east and runs into them, it's going to be kill or get killed. And if Tom won't kill, he's apt to be a dead duck. You may be too worried about that one part of it, Franny said. I mean, if there is a picket line, wouldn't it have to be strung pretty thin? Yeah, one man every 50 miles, something like that. Unless he's got 5 times the people we do. So unless they've got some pretty sophisticated equipment already set up and running, radar and infrared and all that stuff you see in the spy movies, wouldn't Tom be apt to walk right through them? And that's what we're hoping, but... But you've got a bad attack of conscience, she said softly. Is that what it comes to? Maybe so. Harold's got a woman, Fran said. You'd never guess who. He looked up and smiled. I believe that's called changing the subject. Is that what it comes down to? Maybe so. Anyhow, Harold's been working on that burial detail as well as supervising the search committee. He looked very tired. Can you guess who? Who what? Who Harold's lady friend is, stupid? Stu squinted up at the ceiling. Now, who could Harold be shacking with? Let me see. Well, that's a hell of a way to put it. What do you think we're doing? She threw a mock slap at him, and he drew back, grinning. Fun, ain't it? I give up. Who is it? Nadine Cross. That woman with the white in her hair? That's her. Gosh, she must be twice his age. I doubt, Franny said, that it's a concern to Harold at this point in his relationship. Does Larry know? I don't know, and care less. The Cross woman isn't Larry's girl now, if she ever was. Yeah, Stu said. How does Harold feel about the search committee, anyway? Well, you know Harold. He smiles a lot, but not very hopeful. I guess that's why he's putting in most of his time on the burial detail. They call him Hawk now, did you know that? Really? I heard it today. I didn't know who they were talking about until I asked. She mused for a moment, then laughed. What's funny? Stu asked. She stuck out her feet, which were clad in low-topped sneakers. On the soles were patterns of circles and lines. He complimented me on my sneakers, she said. Isn't that dippy? You're dippy, Stu said, grinning. Harold woke up just before dawn and shivered a little bit as he got up. It was getting noticeably colder in the early mornings, although it was only August 22nd and fall was still a calendar month away. But there was heat below his waist. Oh, yes. Just looking at the delectable curve of her buttocks in those tiny see-through underpants as she slept was warming him up considerably. She wouldn't mind if he woke her up. Well, maybe she would mind, but she wouldn't object. He still had no real idea of what might lie behind those dark eyes, and he was a little afraid of her. Instead of waking her up, he dressed quietly. He didn't want to mess around with Nadine as much as he would have liked to. What he needed to do was go someplace alone and think. He paused at the door, fully dressed, carrying his boots in his left hand. Between the slight chilliness of the room and the prosy act of getting dressed, his desire had left him. He could smell the room now. The smell was not that appealing. It was just a little thing, she had said, a thing they could do without. Perhaps it was true. She could do things with her mouth and hands that were nearly beyond belief. But if it was such a small thing, why did this room have that stale and slightly sour odor that he associated with the solitary pleasure of all his bad years? Maybe you wanted to be bad. He went out, closing the door softly behind him. Harold made instant coffee, drank it with a grimace, and then took a couple of cold Pop-Tarts out onto the front step. He sat down and ate them while dawn crept across the land. The last couple of days seemed like a mad carnival ride. It was a blur of orange trucks, of Wyzak clapping him on the shoulder and calling him Hawk, they all called him that now, of dead bodies, a never-ending moldy stream of them, and then coming home from all that death to a never-ending flow of kinky sex, enough to blur your head. But now, sitting here on a front step as cold as a marble headstone, a horrible cup of instant coffee sloshing in his guts, he could munch these sawdust-tasting cold Pop-Tarts and think. He felt clear-headed, sane after a season of insanity. It occurred to him that for a person who had always considered himself to be a Cro-Magnon man amid a herd of thundering Neanderthals, he had been doing precious little thinking lately. He had been led not by the nose, but by the penis. He turned his mind to Franny Goldsmith even as he turned his gaze out to the Flatirons. It was Franny who had been at his house that day. He knew it for sure now. He had gone over on a pretext, really hoping to get a look at her footgear. As it turned out, she had been wearing the sneakers that matched the print he had found on his cellar floor. Circles and lines instead of the usual waffle or zigzag tread. No question, baby. He thought he could put it together without too much trouble. Somehow she had found out he had read her diary. He must have left a smudge or mark on one of the pages, maybe more than one. So she had come to his house looking for some indication of how he felt about what he had read. Something written down. There was, of course, his ledger, but she hadn't found it. He could feel positive of that. His ledger said flat out that he planned to kill Stuart Redman. If she had found something like that, she would have told Stu. Even if she hadn't, he didn't believe she would have been as easy and as natural with him as she had been yesterday. He got up, finishing his breakfast. He decided he would walk to the bus station instead of taking his cycle. Teddy Wyzak or Norris would drop him off on the way home. He set off, zipping his life jacket all the way to his chin against the chill that would be gone in an hour or so. He walked past the empty houses with their shades drawn, and about six blocks down Arapahoe, he began to see an X mark chalked boldly on door after door. Again, his idea. The burial committee had checked all those houses where the mark appeared, and had hauled away whatever bodies there were to be hauled away. X, a crossing out. The people who had lived in those houses where the mark appeared were gone for all time. In another month, that X mark would be all over Boulder, signifying the end of an age. I read her diary because I was hurt and jealous, he thought. Then she broke into my house, probably looking for my own diary, but she didn't find it. But just the shock of someone breaking in had maybe been revenge enough. It had certainly bent him out of shape. Maybe they were even, and it could be quits. He didn't really want Franny anymore, did he? Did he? He felt the sullen coal of resentment glow in his chest. Maybe not. But that didn't change the fact that they had excluded him. Although Nadine had said little about her reasons for coming to him, Harold had an idea that she had been excluded in some way, too. Rebuffed, turned back. They were a couple of outsiders, and outsiders hatch plots. It's perhaps the only thing that keeps them sane. Remember to put that in the ledger, Harold thought. He was almost downtown now. There was a whole company of outsiders on the other side of the mountains. And when there were enough outsiders together in one place, a mystic osmosis takes place, and you're inside. Inside where it's warm. Just a little thing, being inside where it's warm, but really such a big thing. About the most important thing in the world. Maybe he didn't want to be quits and even. Maybe he didn't want to settle for a draw, for a career of riding in a 20th century dead cart and getting meaningless letters of thanks for his ideas and waiting 5 years for Bateman to retire from their precious committee so he could be on it. And what if they decided to pass over him again? The coal of resentment was burning brightly now. He reached the bus station. It was still early, and no one was there yet. There was a poster on the door saying there was going to be another public meeting on the 25th. Public meeting? Public circle jerk. The waiting room was festooned with travel posters and ads for the Greyhound Ameripass and pictures of big mother-humping scenic cruisers cruising through Atlanta, New Orleans, San Francisco, Nashville, wherever. He sat down and stared with a cold morning eye at the darkened pinball machines, the Coke machine, the coffee machine that would also dispense a Lipton cup of soup that smelled vaguely like a dead fish. He lit a cigarette and threw the match stub on the floor. They had adopted the Constitution. Whoopee! How very, very in 2-2. But suppose Harold Lauder had gotten up, not to make a few constructive suggestions, but to tell him the facts of life in this first year after the plague. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Harold Emery Lauder, and I am here to tell you that, in the words of the old song, the fundamental things apply as time goes by. Like Darwin. The next time you stand and sing the national anthem, friends and neighbors, chew on this. America is dead. Dead as a doornail. Dead as Jacob Marley and Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Harry S. Truman. But the principles first propounded by Mr. Darwin are still very much alive. While you are meditating on the beauties of constitutional rule, spare a little time to meditate on Randall Flagg, man of the West. I doubt very much if he has any time to spare for such fripperies as public meetings and ratifications and discussions on the true meaning of a peach in the best liberal mode. Instead, he has been concentrating on the basics, on his Darwin, preparing to wipe the great formica counter of the universe with your dead bodies. Ladies and gentlemen, let me modestly suggest that while we are trying to get the lights on and waiting for a doctor to find our happy little hive, he may be searching eagerly for someone with a pilot's credential so he can start overflights of Boulder in the best Francis Gary Powers tradition. While we debate the burning question of who will be on the street cleaning committee, he has probably already seen to the creation of a gun cleaning committee, not to mention mortars, missile sites, and possibly even germ warfare centers. Of course, we know this country doesn't have any germ or biological warfare centers. That's one of the things that makes this country great. What country, ha-ha? But you should realize that while we're busy getting all the wagons in a circle, that he's... Hey, Hawk, you pulling overtime? Harold looked up, smiling. Yeah, I thought I'd get some, he told Wyzak. I clocked you when I came in. You made $6 already. Wyzak laughed. You're a card, Hawk, you know that? I am, Harold agreed, still smiling. He began to relace his boots. A wild card. Chapter 46. Stu was on his way home at the end of the workday, and he had reached the small park opposite the First National Bank when Ralph hailed him over. He parked his cycle and walked over to the bandshell where Ralph was sitting. I've kind of been looking for you, Stu. You got a minute? Just one. I'm late for supper. Franny will be worried. Yeah. been up to the power station wrapping copper from the look of your hands. Ralph looked absent and worried. Yeah, not even workman's gloves do much good. My hands are wrecked. Ralph nodded. There were maybe half a dozen other people in the park, some of them looking at the narrow-gauge railway train that had once gone between Boulder and Denver. A trio of young women had spread out a picnic supper. Maybe marshalling won't be so bad, he thought. At least it'll get me off that goddamn assembly line in East Boulder. Why are you so down at the mouth, Ralph? I got some news on my radio, Ralph said. Some of it's good, and some of it... well, some of it's not so good, Stu. I want you to know because there's no way to keep it secret. Lots of people in the zone with CBs. I imagine some were listening while I was talking to these new folks coming in. How many? Over 40. One of them's a doctor named George Richardson. Well, that's great news. He's from Derbyshire, Tennessee. Most of the people in this group are sort of mid-southern. Well, it seems they had a pregnant woman with them, and her time come up 10 days ago on the 13th. This doctor delivered her of them, twins she had, and they were fine. At first they were fine. Ralph lapsed back into silence, his mouth working. Stu grabbed him. They died? The babies died? That what you're trying to tell me? They died? Talk to me, damn it! They died, Ralph said in a low voice. One of them went in 12 hours. Appeared to just choke to death. The other went 2 days later. Nothing Richardson could do to save them. The woman went loony, raving about death and destruction and no more babies. You want to make sure Fran isn't around when they come in, Stu. That's what I wanted to tell you. And that you should let her know about this right away, because if you don't, someone else will. Stu let go of Ralph's shirt slowly. This Richardson, he wanted to know how many pregnant women we had, and I said only one that we know of right now. He asked how far along she was, and I said 4 months. Is that right? She's 5 months now. But, Ralph, is he sure those babies died of the superflu? Is he sure? No, he's not, and you got to tell Franny that, too, so she understands it. He said it could have been any number of things. The mother's diet, something hereditary, a respiratory infection. Or maybe they were just, you know, defective babies. He said it could have been the RH factor, whatever that is. He just couldn't tell them being born in the middle of a field beside the doggone Interstate 70. He said that him and about 3 others who were in charge of their group sat up late at night and talked it over. Richardson, he told them what it might mean if it was the Captain Trips that killed those babies, and how important it was for them to find out one way or the other for sure. Glenn and I talked about that, Stu said bleakly, the day I met him. If it was the superflu that killed those babies, it probably means that in 40 or 50 years we can leave the whole shebang to the rats and the houseflies and the sparrows. I guess that's pretty much what Richardson told them. Anyway, they were some 40 miles west of Chicago, and he persuaded them to turn around the next day and take the bodies back to a big hospital where he could do an autopsy. He said he could find out for sure if it was the superflu. He saw enough of it at the end of June. I guess all doctors did. Yeah. But when the morning came, the babies were gone. That woman had buried them, and she wouldn't say where. They spent 2 days digging, thinking that she couldn't have gone too far away from the camp or buried them too deep, being just over her delivery and all. But they couldn't find them. And she wouldn't say where, no matter how much they tried to explain how important it was. Poor woman was just all the way off in a chump. I can understand that, Stu said, thinking of how much Fran wanted her baby. The doctor said even if it was a superflu, maybe 2 immune people could make an immune baby, Ralph said hopefully. The chances that the natural father of Fran's baby was immune are about 1 in a billion, I guess, Stu said. He sure isn't here. Yeah, I guess it couldn't hardly be, could it? I'm sorry to have to put this on you, Stu, but I thought you better know so you could tell her. I don't look forward to that, Stu said. But when he got home, he found that someone else had already done it. Franny? No answer. Supper was on the stove, burnt on mostly, but the apartment was dark and quiet. Stu came into the living room and looked around. There was an ashtray on the coffee table with two cigarette butts in it. But Fran didn't smoke, and they weren't his brand. Babe? He went to the bedroom, and she was there, lying on the bed in the semi-gloom, looking at the ceiling. Her face was puffy and tear-streaked. Hi, Stu, she said quietly. Who told you? Who just couldn't wait to spread the good news? It was Sue Stern. She heard it from Jack Jackson. He's got a CB, and he heard that doctor talking with Ralph. She thought she'd better tell me before someone else made a bad job of it. Poor little Franny, handled with care. Do not open until Xmas. She uttered a little laugh. He came across the room and sat beside her on the bed and stroked hair off her forehead. Honey, it's not sure. No way that it's sure. I know it's not. And maybe we could have our own babies, even so. She turned to look up at him, her eyes red-rimmed and unhappy. But I want this one. Is that so wrong? No, of course not. I've been lying here waiting for him to move or something. I've never felt him move since that night Larry came looking for Harold. Remember? Yes. I felt the baby move and I didn't wake you up. Now I wish I had. I sure do. She began to cry again and put an arm over her face so he wouldn't see her doing it. Stu took the arm away, stretched out beside her, kissed her. She hugged him fiercely and then lay passively against him. When she spoke, the words were half muffled against his neck. Not knowing makes it that much worse. Now I just have to wait and see. It seems like such a long time to have to wait and see if your baby is going to die before it's spent a day outside of your body. You won't be waiting alone, he said. She hugged him tight again for that, and they lay there together without moving for a long time. The meeting at Munsinger Auditorium went well. A census committee was voted routinely, with Sandy Duchenne's in charge. She and her four helpers immediately began going through the audience, counting heads, taking names. At the end of the meeting, to the accompaniment of tremendous cheers, she announced that there were now 814 souls in the free zone and promised, rashly as it turned out, to have a complete directory by the time the next zone meeting was called. A directory she hoped to update week by week, containing names in alphabetical order, ages, Boulder addresses, and previous occupations. As it turned out, the flow into the zone was so heavy and yet so erratic that she was always 2 or 3 weeks behind. The elective period of the Free Zone Committee was brought up, and after some extravagant suggestions, 10 years was one, life another, and Larry brought down the house by saying they sounded more like prison terms than those of elective office. The yearly term was voted in. Harry Dunbarton's hand waved near the back of the hall, and Stu recognized him. Bellowing to make himself heard, Harry said, "Even a year may be too much. I have nothing at all against the ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I think you're doing a hell of a job," cheers and whistles, "but this is going to get out of hand before long if we keep getting bigger." Glenn raised his hand, and Stu acknowledged him. "Mr. Chairman, this isn't on the agenda, but I think Mr. Dunbarton there has an excellent point." "I just bet you think he does, Baldy," Stu thought, "since you brought it up a week ago." "I'd like to make a motion that we have a representative government committee so we can really put the Constitution back to work. I think Harry Dunbarton should head that committee, and I'll serve on it myself, unless someone thinks I've got a conflict of interest." More cheers. In the last row, Harold turned to Nadine and whispered in her ear, "Ladies and gentlemen, the public love feast is now in session." She gave him a slow, dark smile, and he felt giddy. Stu was elected Free Zone Marshal by roaring acclamation. "I'll do the best I can by you," he said. "Some of you cheering me now may have cause to change your tunes later if I catch you doing something you shouldn't be doing. You hear me, Rich Moffat?" A large roar of laughter. Rich, who was drunk as a hoot owl, joined in agreeably. "But I don't see any reason why we should have any real trouble here. The main job of a marshal, as I see it, is stopping people from hurting each other. And there aren't any of us who want to do that. Enough people have been hurt already, and I guess that's all I've got to say." The crowd gave him a long ovation. "Now, this next item," Stu said, "kind of goes along with the marshaling. We need about 5 people to serve on a law committee. Or I'm not going to feel right about locking anyone up should it come to that. Do I hear any nominations? How about the judge? Someone shouted. Yeah, the judge, damn right, someone else yelled. Heads craned expectantly as people waited for the judge to stand up and accept the responsibility. A whisper ran around the hall as people retold the story of how he had put a pin in the flying saucer nuts balloon. Agendas were put down as people prepared to clap. Stu's eyes met Glenn's with mutual chagrin. Someone on the committee should have foreseen this. Ain't here, someone said. Who's seen him? Lucy Swan asked, upset. Larry glanced at her uncomfortably, but she was still looking around the hall for the judge. I seen him. A mutter of interest as Teddy Wyzak stood up about 3/4 of the way back in the auditorium, looking nervous and polishing his steel-rimmed spectacles compulsively with his bandana. There was a barrage of questions from those around him, and Wyzak flinched visibly. Stu pounded with his gavel. Come on, folks, order! I seen him 2 days ago, Teddy said. He had himself a Land Rover. Said he was going to Denver for the day. Didn't say why. That's all I know. He sat down, still polishing his spectacles and blushing furiously. Stu rapped for order again. I'm sorry the judge isn't here. I think he would have been just the man for the job. But since he isn't, could we have another nomination? No, let's not leave it at that, Lucy protested, getting to her feet. She was wearing a snug denim jumpsuit that brought interested looks to the faces of most of the males in the audience. Judge Ferris is an old man. What if he got sick in Denver and can't get back? Lucy, Stu said, Denver's a big place. An odd silence fell over the meeting hall as people considered this. Lucy sat down, looking pale, and Larry put his arm around her. His eyes met Stu's, and Stu looked away. A motion was made to table the law committee until the judge got back and was voted down after 20 minutes of discussion. They had another lawyer, a young man of about 26 named Al Bundle, who had come in late that afternoon with the Dr. Richardson party, and he accepted the chairmanship when it was offered, saying only that he hoped no one would do anything too terrible in the next month or so, because it would take at least that long to work out some sort of rotating tribunal system. Judge Ferris was voted a place on the committee in absentia. Brad Kitchener, looking pale, fidgety, and a little ridiculous in a suit and tie, approached the podium, dropped his prepared remarks, picked them up in the wrong order, and contented himself by saying they hoped and expected to have the electricity back on by the 2nd or 3rd of September. This remark was greeted with such a storm of cheering that he gained enough confidence to finish in style and actually strut a little as he left the podium. Chad Norris was next, and Stu told Franny later that he had approached the thing in just the right way. They were burying the dead out of common decency. None of them would feel really good until that was done and life could go on, and if it was finished by the fall rainy season, they would all feel so much the better. He asked for a couple of volunteers and could have had 36 if he wanted them. He finished by asking each member of the current burial committee to stand and take a bow. Harold Lauder barely popped up and then sat back down again, and there were those who left the meeting remarking on what a smart but very modest fellow he was. Actually, Nadine had been whispering things in his ear, and he was afraid to do too much more than bob and nod. He had an erection. When Norris left the podium, Ralph Brentner took his place. He told them that they at last had a doctor, had George Richardson stand up. To loud applause, Richardson flipped the peace sign with both hands, and the applause turned to cheers. And then told them that, as far as he could tell, they had another 60 people joining them over the next couple of days. Well, that's the agenda, Stu said. He looked out over the gathered people. I want Sandy Deschenes to come up here again and tell us how many we are, but before I do that, is there any other business we should take up tonight? He waited. He could see Glenn's face in the crowd, and Sue Stern's, Larry's, Nick's, and of course Franny's. They all looked a bit strained. If someone was going to bring up Flagg, ask what the committee was doing about him, this would be the time. But there was silence. After 15 seconds of it, Stu turned the meeting over to Sandy, who ended things in style. As people began to file out, Stu thought, well, we got by it again. Several people came up to congratulate him after the meeting, one of them the new doctor. "You handled that very well, Marshal," Richardson said, and for a moment Stu almost looked over his shoulder to see who Richardson was talking to. Then he remembered and suddenly felt scared. Lawman? He was an imposter. A year, he told himself. A year and no more. But he still felt scared. Stu, Fran, Sue Stern, and Nick walked back together, their feet clicking hollowly on the cement sidewalk as they crossed the CU campus toward Broadway. Around them, other people were streaming away, talking quietly, headed home. It was nearly 11:30. "It's chilly," Fran said. "I wish I'd worn my jacket." Nick nodded. He also felt the chill. The Boulder evenings were always cool, but tonight it could be no more than 50 degrees. It served to remind them that this strange and terrible summer was nearing its end. Not for the first time he wished that Mother Abigail's god, or muse, or whatever it was, had been more in favor of Miami or New Orleans. But that might not have been so great now that he stopped to think about it. High humidity, lots of rain, and lots of bodies. "They jumped the shit out of me wanting the judge for the law committee," Sue said. "We should have expected that." "Think people will be suspicious, Nick?" Stu asked. Nick nodded. "They'll wonder if he did go west, for real." They all considered this as Nick took out his butane match and burned the scrap of paper. "That's tough," Stu said finally. "You really think..." "Sure he's right," Sue said glumly. "What else have they got to think? That he went to Far Rockaway to ride the monster coaster?" "We were lucky to get away tonight without a big discussion of what's going on in the West," Fran said. Nick wrote, "Sure were. That's why I want to postpone another big meeting as long as possible. 3 weeks, maybe. September 15th? Sue said, "We can hold off that long if Brad gets the power on." "I think he will," Stu said. "I'm going home," Sue told them. "Big day tomorrow. Dana's off. I'm going with her as far as Colorado Springs." "How did she take it?" Fran asked her. "Well, she's a funny sort of girl. She was a jock in college, you know. Tennis and swimming were her biggies, although she played them all. She went to some small community college down in Georgia, but for the first 2 years, she kept on going with her high school boyfriend. He was a big leather jacket type. Me, Tarzan, you, Jane, so get out in the kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. Then she got dragged along to a couple of female consciousness meetings by her roomie, who was this big libber type. And as an upshot, she got to be an even bigger libber than the roomie," Fran guessed. "First a libber, then a lesbian," Sue said. Stu stopped as if thunderstruck. Franny looked at him with guarded amusement. "Come on, Splendor in the Grass," she said. "See if you can't fix the hinge on your mouth." Stu shut his mouth with a snap. Sue went on. "She dropped both rocks and the caveman boyfriend at the same time, and he came after her with a gun. She disarmed him. She says it was the major turning point of her life. She told me she always knew she was stronger and more agile than he was. She knew it intellectually, but it took doing it to put it in her guts." "You saying she hates men?" Stu asked, looking at Sue closely. Susan shook her head. "She's bi now." "Bi now?" Stu said doubtfully. "She's happy with either sex, Stuart. And I hope you're not going to start leaning on the committee to institute the blue laws along with Thou Shalt Not Kill." "I got enough to worry about without worrying about who sleeps with who," he mumbled, and they all laughed. "I only ask because I don't want anyone going into this thing as a crusade. We need eyes over there, not guerrilla fighters." "She knows that," Susan said, and said no more. What else Dana Juergens had said was between the two of them, something not even the other members of the committee were to know, as was the fact that Dana was going west with a 10-inch switchblade strapped to her arm in a spring-loaded clip. If he's a big enough dictator, then maybe he's all that's holding them together. If he was gone, maybe they'd start fighting and squabbling among themselves. It might be the end of them if he dies. And if I get close to him, Susie, he better have his guardian devil with him." "They'll kill you, Dana." "Maybe, maybe not. It might be worth it just to have the pleasure of watching his guts fall out on the floor." She could have stopped her, maybe, but she hadn't tried. She had contented herself with extracting a promise from Dana that she would stick to the original script unless a near-perfect opportunity came up. To that, Dana had agreed, and Sue didn't think her friend would get that chance. Flag would be well guarded. "Well," she said to the rest of them, "I'm home to bed. Really. Night, folks." She walked off, hands in the pockets of her fatigue jacket. "She looks older," Stu said. Nick wrote and offered the open pad to both of them. "We all do," was written there. Stu was on his way up to the power station the next morning when he saw Susan and Dana headed down Canyon Boulevard on a pair of cycles. He waved and they pulled over. He thought he had never seen Dana looking prettier. Her hair was tied behind her with a bright green silk scarf, and she was wearing a rawhide coat open over jeans and a chambray shirt. A bedroll was strapped on behind her. "Stuart," she said. "Lesbian?" he thought doubtfully. "I understand you're off on a little trip," he said. "For sure, and you never saw me." "Nope," Stu said, "I never did. Have a smoke?" Dana took one of Stu's Marlboros and cupped her hands over his match. "You be careful, girl."
"I will."
"And get back."
"I hope to."
They looked at each other in the bright late summer morning. "You take care of Franny, big fella."
"I will."
"And go easy on the marshalling."
"That I know I can do."
She cast the cigarette away. "What do you say, Suze?" Susan nodded and put her bike in gear, smiling a strained smile. "Dana?" She looked at him, and Stu planted a soft kiss on her mouth. "Good luck." She offered him a slow smile. "You have to do it twice for good luck, didn't you know that?" He kissed her again. "Franny's a lucky woman," Dana said, "and you can quote me." Smiling, not really knowing what to say, Stu stepped back and said nothing at all. Two blocks up, one of the lumbering orange burial committee trucks rumbled through the intersection, and the moment was broken. "Let's go, kid," Dana said. They drove off, and Stu stood on the curbing and watched them. Sue Stern was back 2 days later. She had watched Dana moving west from Colorado Springs, she said, had watched her until she was nothing but a speck that merged with the great still landscape. Then she had cried a little. That first night, Sue had made camp at Monument and had awakened in the small hours, chilled by a low whining sound that seemed to be coming from a culvert that traveled beneath the farm road she had camped by. Finally, summoning up her courage, she had shined her flash into the corrugated pipe and had discovered a gaunt and shivering 6 months puppy. It shied from her touch, and she was too big to crawl into the pipe. At last she had gone into the town of Monument, had smashed her way into the local grocery, and had come back in the first cold light of false dawn with a knapsack full of Alpo and Cycle One. That did the trick. The puppy rode back with her, neatly tucked into one of the big BSA saddlebags. Dick Ellis went into raptures over the puppy. It was an Irish setter bitch, either purebred or so close as to make no difference. When she got older, he was sure Kojak would be glad to make her acquaintance. The news swept the free zone, and for that day the subject of Mother Abigail was forgotten in the excitement over the canine Adam and Eve. Susan Stern became something of a heroine, and as far as any of the committee ever knew, no one even thought to wonder what she'd been doing in Monument that night, far south of Boulder. But it was the morning the two of them left Boulder that Stu remembered, watching them ride off toward the Denver-Boulder turnpike, because no one in the zone ever saw Dana Juergens again. Nearly dusk, Venus shining against the sky. Nick, Ralph, Larry, and Stu sat on the steps of Tom Cullen's house. Tom was on the lawn, whooping and knocking croquet balls through a set of wickets. "It's time," Nick wrote. Speaking low, Stu asked if they would have to hypnotize him again, and Nick shook his head. Ralph called Tom, who came running over, grinning.
"Tommy, it's time to go," Ralph said.
Tom's smile faltered. For the first time, he seemed to notice that it was getting dark.
"Go? Now? Laws, no! When it gets dark, Tom goes to bed. M-O-O-N, that spells bed. Tom doesn't like to be out after dark. because of the boogies. Tom...
He fell silent, and the others looked at him uneasily. Tom had lapsed into dull silence. He came out of it, but not in the usual way. It was not a sudden reanimation, life flooding back in a rush, but a slow thing, reluctant, almost sad. "Go west," he said. Stu laid a hand on his shoulder. "Yes, Tom, if you can." "On the road." Ralph made a choked muttering sound and walked around the house. Tom did not seem to notice. His gaze alternated between Stu and Nick. "Travel at night, sleep in the day." "Very slowly in the dusk," Tom added. "And see the elephant." Nick nodded. Larry brought Tom's pack up from where it had rested beside the steps. Tom put it on slowly, dreamily. "You want to be careful, Tom," Larry said thickly.
"Careful. Laws, yes."
Stu wondered belatedly if they should have given Tom a one-man tent as well, and rejected it. Tom would get all bollocksed up trying to set up even a little tent.
"Nick," Tom whispered, "do I really have to do this?"
Nick put an arm around Tom and nodded slowly.
"All right.
Just stay on the big four-lane highway, Tom," Larry said. "The one that says 70. Ralph was going to drive you down to the start of it on his motorcycle."
"Yes, Ralph."
He paused. Ralph had come back around the house. He was swabbing at his eyes with his bandana.
"You ready, Tom?"
he asked gruffly.
"Nick, will it still be my house when I get back?"
Nick nodded vigorously.
"Tom loves his house, laws, yes."
"We know you do, Tommy."
Stu could feel warm tears in the back of his own throat now.
"All right, I'm ready. Who am I riding with?"
"Me, Tom," Ralph said. "Down to Route 70, remember?"
Tom nodded and began to walk toward Ralph's cycle. After a moment, Ralph followed him, his big shoulders slumped. Even the feather in his hat band seemed dejected. He climbed on the bike and kicked it alive. A moment later, it pulled out onto Broadway and turned east. They stood together, watching them dwindle to a moving silhouette in the purple dusk, marked by a moving headlight. Then the light disappeared behind the bulk of the Holiday Twin Drive-In and was gone. Nick walked away, head down, hands in pockets. Stu tried to join him, but Nick shook his head and motioned him away. Stu went back to Larry.
"That's that," Larry said, and Stu nodded gloomily.
"You think we'll ever see him again, Larry?" "If we don't, the seven of us, well, maybe not Fran, she was never for sending him. The rest of us are going to be eating and sleeping with the decision to send him for the rest of our lives. I wish sometimes I'd never heard of the motherfucking Free Zone Committee." They looked at Tom's darkened house in silence for a minute. "Let's get out of here," Larry said suddenly. "The thought of all those stuffed animals, all of a sudden I got a grade A case of the creeps." When they left, Nick was still standing on the side lawn of Tom Cullen's house, his hands in his pockets, his head down. George Richardson, the new doctor, had set up in the Dakota Ridge Medical Center because it was close to Boulder City Hospital with its medical equipment, its large supplies of drugs, and its operating rooms.